Hello, and welcome again to Comic Connoisseurs. Tonight we'll be talking about our favorite trades, graphic novels. You can also know my co-host, JT from Saskatoon.
Hello.
And also with us is Red Ink.
Greetings and salutations.
All right, and as always, first part of the show, we're going to go through some of these this week's solicitations and talk about the comics that came out. So let's see here. Immediately, Airship Entertainment, Girl Genius Volume 13. Love Phil Foglio.
Still haven't read that webcomic.
It's you're gonna need like an afternoon. I see another favorite of JT's. You remember last week we were talking about 32-bit zombie?
Yes.
Looks like you got an upgrade. It's now 64-bit zombie.
I love these knockoffs. I really do.
Yes.
By Fred Perry.
Excellent. Fred Perry has said he will be on the show, but he's never contacted me to arrange a time. So, we need to get that done. Moving on. Anything you see interest you guys at all in the next little bit of the
list? I see the Avatar Press, the brand that Garth Ennis built.
Ennis has ups and downs. He's...
Well, for every
like a valley.
For every cross, there's Welcome Back, Frank. So, let's see.
Okay.
Let's see. Boom Studios. We got Bee and Puppy Cat.
Yes, which we have to mention because if we don't, Kitty Hawk will get mad
and she'll pout. And oh, Clive Barker started Nightbreed again. I must have missed that.
RoboCop, the human element. Continuation of the shitty movie.
Oh, like the reboot?
Yes.
Yeah, I saw that.
It wasn't
shitty, but it wasn't that good either.
I'd buy that for a dollar.
They actually did work that line into the movie, though. I was amazed. And they gave it to the right guy to say it, Jack Ural Haley, so...
Hey, here's one for you, JT.
Mm-hmm.
Six-Gun Gorilla.
I have the complete series in single issues, and I'm getting the trade.
Knew it.
Well, first of all, I picked up the first issue that I see solely on the title.
I know you did.
And I was right to pick it up because it was actually pretty damn good.
See, I know you. I know you well. You want to pick up something called Six Gun Gorilla. If there was a comic called Captain Trapezoid and his merry band of misfit mice, you would buy it because of the name.
No, I wouldn't because that sounds retarded.
It's Six Gun Gorilla. It sounds like the epitome
it sounds
of
like
refinement.
Fun. It sounds like fun.
Okay, then you would probably pick up a book entitled "The Big Bombino and the Ace Capers."
I possibly might look at it. I couldn't guarantee whether or not that I would pick it up. But then again, I buy Serial Geek magazine on a regular basis. So.
Yes, moving further down the list.
it's a great magazine. I mean, for those listening, if you have any amount of love for 80s animation, I would recommend you pick up each and every issue of Serial Geek magazine. It's a basically a fan-produced magazine. They interview everybody involved in from like Filmation, Hanna-Barbera, Rankin Bass, Ruby Spears. Like, they talk to anybody and everybody that ever worked in like 80s animation. And they actually have a lot of cool articles. They have stuff like Whatever Happened to Brave Star. And they actually write it out that, you know, in the future, Tex Hex goes off and he, you know, works his way into the inner workings of the Galactic Senate or whatever. And basically, he becomes the law in New Texas or Bravestar becomes an outlaw. And they have this one, what if our favorite 80s TV shows were cartoons? And they've turned stuff like A-Team, Knight Rider, Auto Man, and they get actual comic book artists to draw quote-unquote animated versions, like in a lineup of the cast of characters, and they come up with a premise that would work.
Sell
it, you
kids.
Know. Well, yeah, but it's...
Michael Knight is a man.
A-Team was a cartoon, wasn't it?
No, Mr. T was a cartoon.
Okay.
Yeah, they had the A-Team, they did Auto Man, which came right out of nowhere, they did The Fall Guy, they even had Manimal one issue.
I would read a Knight Rider comic.
There's one out now. It's a, I forget the company. It's like Lion Press or something like that.
There's one thing to remember about Knight Rider.
What's that?
Screw you, Val Kilmer.
I would agree with that.
I mean, no one will... way too robotic to be Kit.
I liked his performance for what it was, but nobody will touch. Nobody will touch Mr. Feeny. And if you know what I'm talking about when I say that 5 points,
yes,
to
I
you.
Do. But like I said, is what Val Kilmer did was a farce.
I don't think it was a farce. It wasn't what we wanted it to be, or what really.
Well, what, you know, all we wanted was a good show.
It was on NBC in primetime in the 2000s. What did you expect?
Something at least of Heroes quality, but that didn't even hit that note.
Which season of Heroes?
The worst season of Heroes. I mean, they killed Knight Rider quicker than they killed. Okay.
They brought it around in the last few episodes, but that was after they kind of resolved the overarching plot of the season, and then it just kind of petered out. But I mean, once they got back to, like, you know, one dude in his car with a small team backing him up, you know, when they got it back to, like, kind of the core concept of Knight Rider, the episodes got reasonably better. I mean, to their credit, they did get Peter Cullen back to voice Carr, which was nice.
He made a fucking Transformer, though.
I didn't say it was good.
let's move on, because we've more than gone off topic. We got some Dark Horse here.
Ooh, new Dream Thief, and I would highly recommend you pick up the first miniseries of Dream Thief, because it's actually interesting. It's a guy gets high with a friend at this museum show, and they decide to steal an Aboriginal dream mask. And then the guy becomes, whenever he falls asleep, he becomes possessed by ghosts who want to, like, get revenge on the people that killed them. So he's kind of like a narcoleptic heat man. It's a lot better than I describe it.
Anyways, we also have here something very interesting. We got Frank Miller's Big Damn Sin City, whatever.
Isn't that a movie now?
A Dame to Kill For, coming out.
Well, yes, but this isn't Dame, this is Damn. Let's see here. Some Star Wars comics, Tomb Raider comics, DC comics, okay, and then moving on. We have... Hey, until they put something out good, I'm not gonna, you know, stick around too long.
I'd point out something that I like this week, but it references a writer, and that would, you know, have Ben fall into a fit of rage, so we'll just move on from that.
Tom Strong?
No, not
Tom. Now that looks interesting.
Yeah, that's the miniseries. Tom Strong goes back to the, was it anti-Earth or counter-Earth or whatever they call it in here, and it's basically filled with, like, science heroes that have appeared in previous Strong Tom series, and a lot of these characters that he meets have been used in other miniseries. Like, Dynamite Comics had that Project Superpowers a couple years ago, because a lot of these characters that they use in the series, they're, what do you call them, public domain?
Yes.
So it's you see some characters in here, like, I think there's, like, there was an Electro-Man or Dynaman's, this one guy. There's a new version of the Black Terror. But it's a Tom Strong comic, and it's absolutely beautiful art by Chris Sprouse, and the characterization is dead on from, you know, what Alan Moore originally wrote.
Yes, I do love some Tom Strong. Let's move further down. We got some Dynamite with Flash Gordon.
Ah!
Save the others. Anyways.
Flash Gordon. Mark Waid's Green Hornet still going strong, which is
yes. Solar Man of the Atom, number 3.
Shouldn't it be Woman of the Atom at this point? If you've been reading the comics, you'll know of which I speak.
Yes.
And there's... the trade. I got to pick that up. The trade of Army of Darkness versus Hack Slash.
Yes, I remember you were telling me about that.
It was a great miniseries. It's like kind of, you know, this is what happens next sort of mentality. And unfortunately, I missed the last two issues of that, so now I have to pick up the trade, because I've checked all three stores in town and the local used comic shop, and no one's got nothing.
Yes, and JT has a double negative. But let's move on. We got some IDW here. 24. And Ghostbusters, number 17.
That's it. Three more issues.
Yes.
You didn't read Cartoon Network's Super Secret Crisis War?
Oh, boy.
What?
They're doing a miniseries where Dexter and
Bleedman.
Okay, moving on.
It's not drawn by Bleedman or written by Bleedman, but basically doing Bleedman's thing without paying Bleedman. And you know what? I'm okay with it because it's like, because this is what happens when you do fan fiction on licensed characters. The license holder can do it again themselves, and you have no recourse. Sorry, Bleedman. You deserve it.
Let's see, further down the list, Ninja Turtles New Animated Adventures. And I did like that. I did pick up the Transformers Spotlight Drift Director's Cut. Have you guys ever read any of that IDW Transformers stuff?
I thumbed through it. You know, some of it's okay. Some of it takes itself way too damn seriously.
I don't know, I think a lot of the thing I like mainly about the Transformers or the IDW Transformers is they've written it in a way that you really don't care if there's humans involved or not. Like, they've basically made the characters into actual characters. You know, you care about, with this new universe, you actually care about the backstories and the history of a lot of the characters, not just the fact that there's this, you know, Cybertronian Civil War. And Drift is, for those that don't know, is basically, well, he's a samurai transformer is the easiest way to describe him. He's a former Decepticon war criminal who had a crisis, a crisis of faith, or, you know, he had that moment of clarity and he switched sides.
Dinobot.
What's that?
Dinobot.
How is he a Dinobot?
The character Dinobot from Beast Wars.
That's
oh, Dinobots. Like Dinobot. Sorry, I was thinking like Grimlock and gang there for a second.
But moving on, we also have Image Comics here. We have Invincible 112 with some more goddamn bloody violence. It almost feels weird reading it, seeing the direction that the author's taking it. You know,
to me, it feels like it's coming to an end.
It feels like it should have ended a year ago. There, I said it.
True, but it feels like he's trying to wrap it up now.
True. Let's move on. We got some Marvel comics here. We got let's see here. We got anyone want to talk about anything from Marvel that you like lately?
I'm still digging the all-new Ghost Rider, avoiding all-new dupe, like the bloody plague. I'm still working my way through my pile this week, so I haven't read Spider-Man yet, although what they've done so far bringing it back has actually been kind of very entertaining, I'll say.
J. Jonah Jameson is now a host of his own TV show, like Bill Maher. Mm-hmm.
Well, what else are they going to do with him? He certainly can't be chief editor of the Daily Bugle anymore.
He was mayor of New York for a while.
Yeah.
And now he's Bill Maher. Such a sad state of affairs. But moving on, we have got some new Avengers. We got Wolverine, where they're doing the storyline where they're going to finally kill Wolverine.
Yeah. I did pick up this week and read that Original Sin 3.1 actually has has any of us besides me read the Original Sin miniseries?
I'm kind of waiting for it to be a trade before I read it.
Okay. Well, basically in this one, there something happens in the ongoing miniseries that cracks a spotlight on the origin of the Hulk and how Tony Stark may or may not have had a hand in Bruce Banner getting irradiated.
Because everyone's related now.
It's except for all Tony Stark, connected!
Except for Tony Stark, because he is technically an orphan. Aww.
He was adopted. He wasn't an orphan for very long.
It's a joke. Anyways, let's move forward. You know, we have some asterisks from Orion.
God, I loved reading those growing up.
I did too. We got Judge Dredd magazine from Rebellion. That's interesting. Let's see here. Oh, one of your favorites, JT, WWE Superstars, Volume Woo! 1, Money in the Bank.
Is anyone else besides me not surprised that they named the collection after one of their pay-per-views?
I'm not surprised at all.
I call that. I actually got to collect on a $5 bet with a friend now because of that.
Interesting. Let's move down. We got... okay, and that's the solicitations for this week. You know, right when we pass the S's, you know, there's not that many publishers left with anything we really want to talk about. You know, so when we come back, we'll have the topic of the show.
It's time for intermission, boys and girls.
Like animation? Come listen to Animation Aficionados.
And if you disagree with us, you could be a guest on a future show.
Available on iTunes, the Zune Market, and animationaficionados.com.
Hey, I'm Gary.
I'm Mike.
I'm Chuck.
And I'm Justin.
Join the four of us every week on the Internet's number one and longest-running G.I. Joe podcast, What's on Joe Mind?
It's Joe news, reviews, and interviews like you've never heard them before, delivered right to your MP3 player.
Our guests include Jason Marsden, Kevin Michael Richardson, and Matt Yang King from G.I. Joe Renegades, Larry Hama, Robert Adkins, and John Barber from IDW Publishing, and many more from around the online Joe community.
Yeah, it's guys talking about Joe. Think of it as Joe Talk meets Sports Talk. And we make fun of Chuck.
Right, and we... Hey, again?
Come on, Chuck. We're just kidding, kinda.
Sometimes Chuck makes fun of himself.
Right, and we... Okay, seriously, this is just getting ridiculous now.
It's What's on Joe Mind, every week on the GeekCast Radio Network, InsidePulse.com, Stitcher Smart Radio, and iTunes. Download and listen today.
I suppose I still can't say something about Transformers, can I?
Good.
No.
What about sports?
That sounds good.
Yeah, that's all right.
It's action. It's drama. It's comedy. It's DeCian, the superhero webcomic. DeCian's got superhero antics and sexy girls. Read it now at DeCian.com. DASIEN.com.
And now, back to the show.
And we're back to talk about our favorite graphic novels and trades. Let's see here. last week I provided the list of my favorites. Let's talk about a couple of those.
All right.
Which choice do you think was the strangest out of my list?
Strangest? I'm going to say No Man's Land.
I enjoyed No Man's Land.
I think it's the strangest because I didn't think you'd come out with something like that.
It's one of the things that when I transitioned from someone who merely just watched cartoons about superheroes to reading comic books about superheroes, one of the things that got me interested in, you know, this large ensemble cast that a character like Batman has carrying his book was a trade like No Man's Land. Does that make sense? Because if one thing No Man's Land did well was showcase the whole ensemble cast that Gotham City has.
Well, the Bat family, yeah.
No, not just the Bat family, but the nuance of all these, you know, from, you know, Mr. Zazz to Scarface to all the weird, you know, C and D list villains that Batman has.
Yeah, and it was also during No Man's Land that they introduced Harley Quinn, right?
Officially, yes.
Into the DCU.
Yes, and as I said, officially, because she made her animated... pardon me, a little bit of a yawn there. She made her animated debut earlier and was such a hit character that they ported her over, just like Montoya.
Yeah, although Montoya showed up a lot earlier than... Why do you think it took so long for Harley to show up versus Montoya?
Montoya was easy to slip in because, we need a cop for Jim Gordon to interact with. To have a character that's affectionate to the Joker would be such a huge, you know, headliner that it would require a lot of thought of how to do it. And to be quite frank and honest, is the animated Joker is a much more cuddly Joker than the comics were using at the time.
Well, it's the Joker as a character, like, for years, flip-flop. He's a murderer. He's a comedian. He's a murderer. He's a comedian.
He's both.
Well, he's both, but, I mean, you look, like, the storyline they had in, like, Justice League International, where he became, like, the ambassador to this Middle East nation, you know, and he's trying to, like, get a nuclear bomb, and he's trying to become a threat, but it was just played, like, a lot of the characters in that series, it was played for laughs. And, you know, and then you have the Joker that beat Jason Todd to death with a crowbar in that warehouse. So,
well, like I said, is to me, Dixon's work with No Man's Land and the way that he created this this interest in this huge ensemble cast that was the entirety of Gotham City, and these concepts of how Batman operates is stuff that really interested me, because It was much more than just, oh, you know, my parents are dead. It's much more than that. And I think it was a good first start. There was an idiotic scene about people trying to steal bullets from a morgue, but I'm not going to get into that because that scene was just so stupidly written. But that's another story. So No Man's Land, I'm going to defend it. There's some of the... there were some artists I preferred over others during it, but one of my favorite stories was Two-Face holding Jim Gordon on trial. And Montoya demanded he had a lawyer and demanded that his lawyer be Harvey Dent.
I it's been years since I read, but I do kind of vaguely remember that.
The art on that story, not a huge fan of it, but the writing, solid. Because you got the inkling that, you know, Two-Face isn't just, oh, some guy who has a duality thing and robs banks. It's, there actually is a decent human being buried underneath there somewhere.
Yeah, it's just, I do, because they kind of played, like, even the art, like, they had a certain style for Two-Face's speech balloon, then they had, like, a regular clean one for Harvey.
Yes.
Something like that. And that's also where they kind of built up, like, where Harvey's, like, Two-Face's into Montoya, and they really left that hanging for the longest time until she got outed in Gotham Central years later.
Yep. And the sad thing is, it's like, you know, you sort of almost believe that Two-Face could disappear. Harvey could become a person again. If, you know, I'm not putting any blame on Montoya as a character at all in this, but you know, if that worked out, but because Montoya is who she is, that won't work out. So it's a little bit more of that tragedy, if that makes sense.
No, it does make sense.
But like I said, that's one pick I have to defend. It's because, like I said, it had a great emphasis in, you know, I wouldn't say world building, but world maintenance.
Well, it kind of broke things down and then literally and
built them back up.
Figuratively built it back up. I mean, especially.
I mean, anyone who has only a passing familiarity with the Bat Family in the 90s and wants to, like, get a good jumping point of understanding, you know, Barbara Gordon's role as Oracle, you know, the roles of Huntress, of Jim Gordon, of Robin, etc. This is the one to pick up to, like, help you in your mind define these roles before certain writers fucked it all up, like, you know, years later. Yeah, so I'm going to defend my choice on this. You know, one of the first graphic novels I bought was The World's Finest that I put on this list. It was Giffen and Kessel as the writers. And I just really enjoyed the hell out of this one because You have this story where Batman and Superman swap cities. You have the some Joker.
The Joker and Luthor. I just to say some absolutely beautiful art by Steve Rude.
Oh, yes. And the funny thing is this. Whenever there's a parking lot shot, Steve Rude always likes to throw like a couple, you know, having sex in like the back of a pickup.
I'm going to have to go back and read this now because I never noticed that.
It's in there. It's in there multiple times in that trade. I promise you.
Well, I'm not saying. I'm going to have to go back and play a little Where's Waldo.
It's pretty obvious, too. Hold on one second. Let me grab my copy really quick.
Yeah. Now, have you read this World's Finest Red?
Not a...
Yeah. Like, do you know who Steve Rude is? Like, have you ever read Nexus?
Okay. I actually have his book on inking.
Ah. No, see, what I knew of Steve Rude, and I knew he, like, you know, was one of the creators involved with Nexus. My big thing with him is, like, I got into Steve Rude with this miniseries called The Moth. I think it was from, like, Dark Horse. It's basically this guy who, he ran a traveling circus and performed as The Moth, but he was also kind of like a licensed bounty hunter, so to supplement the circus's income, you know, he went out in the moth costume to catch down bail jumpers and such. And it was done in a really kind of, like, he didn't have, like, any recurring supervillains or anything like that. It's just, it was kind of more of a Pulp Fiction-y sort of story. And his art is, it's kind of, like, similar in some respects to Mike Allred, that he has this, there's what I've said before in the show, is he's got this touch of the Silver Age in his art. Like, it's very clean and dynamic and expressive, but it's not overly wrought. So you can't really... There's not a lot of bad lines in Steve Rude's art, and especially in this World's Finest series. In fact, I think the inking is probably some of the favorite that I've seen on any of his work.
And the thing that's interesting is the foreword written by Gibbons, where he said that he wanted to... he really wanted to go and use the basic, you know, original, you know, he wanted to use the Action Number 1 version of Superman and the Detective 27 version of Batman in this, updated for the, you know, just for the continuity's sake, but, you know, visually that's what he wanted to do, and DC came down on him, and he had to relent on Batman.
Come on, you can't have Batman with purple gloves.
But Superman, he would not budge on. So that's why, you know, this is right around mullet time in continuity. And, you know, Supes has no mullet here.
I mean, this, is this World's Finest, is this considered an Elseworlds, or is this in continuity?
I believe this is considered an appendix.
So it's basically post-crisis and just an untold tale sort of thing?
Yes.
Okay.
Because it doesn't really create anything that's truly earth-shattering that would affect continuity, but at the same time it doesn't, you know, hurt it either.
Yeah. Well, it props it up more than anything. I mean, he's not so much like OG Superman. Like, he's got flight, he's got heat vision in this, but I think it's more the mentality that Superman is written with.
Yes, that's true. And like I said, they definitely, you know, he had to relent with Batman a lot on a lot of spots. But one thing I did like was there were several great scenes in this. You know, there's lots of images that invoke classic Superman. You know, Christopher Reeve era Superman, Kurt Swan Superman. I mean, it's you have lots of Fleischer art too, you know, inspiration as well, because when Superman shows up, he's squinting, as he should. But this is great because, you know, like I said, it is in the post-crisis continuity, because you have Barbara Gordon in a wheelchair, you have Lex Luthor with the kung fu grip metal hand.
Yeah.
So,
oh God, I forgot about that.
Well, now you don't. So, another story of mine that I picked on my list that, you know, what I call the best goddamn Superman story that doesn't actually have Superman in it.
Superboy Prime?
It's not Superboy Prime.
And it's Super Bitch Prime. Get it right.
It's Superman Secret Identity. It has lots of similar, you know, themes to the classic Superboy Prime story, except this is a lot more heartfelt and warm and awesome.
I actually took the time to read it this week, and there's a really good Superman story.
So let's recommend it. So you do recommend it too?
Yeah.
All right, well, let's talk about this story a little bit. It's about the real world, so to speak, where a couple in a small Kansas farming town, the Kents, have a baby, and they decide to jokingly name him Clark. And the young Clark Kent lives a life where every birthday people give him Superman-related gifts. They joke about him, they tease him. And he's just a normal kid. Until one day he wakes up and he has Superman's powers. And the thing that really is beautiful to me about this is the fact that, you know, here's a story where you have this kid, this good kid, who gets the powers of Superman, and, you know, just through, like, you know, I'm considering it like this quasi-spiritual connection to this fictional character. He is a good person. He becomes something that lives up to the ideal of Superman. And to me, that's something special.
Yeah.
Because, like I said, there's no revenge fantasy here. Because the thing is this. He realizes he could get revenge on the bully that beat him up. But the thing is, he realizes that that's very useless. There's no point in that. I mean, that's the thing is, he's like, okay, I could hurt this guy, but why? Why would I? What does that get me? And that to me is Superman. That to me is what the essence should be. And I just love this book. JT, you've been pretty silent about this.
We have talked about this on an earlier episode, but I enjoy this series. I don't enjoy it on the level that you do. You know, obviously, not to do it a disservice. Like, I see it as, you know, a what if in Elseworlds, but it is a great story. I mean, because especially I can't say I would have the wherewithal that this version of Clark, say that happened to me. And, well, there's going to be a smoking pair of sneakers on the sidewalk. I'm not going to lie. Like, I got picked on a lot as kids. Don't think I'd be able to hold back. But I mean, how they use, or not how they use, but as the course that this version of Clark's life takes is really what I enjoyed about the series, about, you know, what he went through as a kid trying to figure out his powers, to him becoming a writer and marrying a woman named Lois. You know, he's like, oh, geez. Because they literally have that moment in the comics where, as a joke, his coworkers set him up with a woman named Lois. Well, your name's Clark Kent, you know, you should be with a Lois. It's kind of how they played with some of the conventions of Superman and is what he has to go through, what he has to worry about, like, you know, where he starts working for the government and, you know, he basically misses the birth of his daughters. And
again, is another scene I loved was when he's actually captured by the government and he has this weird, like, fever dream that's almost quasi-spiritual, where, you know, it's like he's getting, you know, he's linked to the fictional Superman, and you see this link through this fever dream where he's imagined he's captured by Brainiac and Lex Luthor. I mean, maybe I read a little too much in that scene, but it's one of the scenes that really stuck with me.
No, I get that.
You know the scene I'm talking about, Red?
I know the scene you're talking about, yeah. Where he's in the laboratory and then he breaks out.
Yes.
And he finds the corpses.
What? He finds the corpses, yeah. And, you know, like I said, I can't recommend this book enough. To me, this is the quintessential Superman story that shows the ideal of Superman, the concept of Superman, in a way that is easiest to explain to somebody who doesn't understand and, you know, is closed-minded to it, you know. But, you know, let's move forward. You know, let's talk about the last pick on my list.
And which one's that, Ben?
Actually, I don't remember.
We'll put a pin in that.
What? No, it wasn't fucking Our World's at Fucking War.
Jesus, you don't want to rock the dragon from Krypton?
Actually, no, that was my list.
Okay. Well, it's, I'll let you go first then. Red, sorry.
Well, is there anything that stands out on my list that I gave you guys?
I'm going to be honest, I didn't see Superman Red Sun coming, so why don't we start with that?
Well, just like Ben said, describing a Superman story from another angle, Superman Red Sun pretty much captures the same thing. It's basically Superman arrives 12 hours later than he did in Smallville. And he lands in the Ukraine. And he's raised as a Russian citizen. And he's raised with communist values and stuff like that. But he's still Superman. He still saves the day. He's still basically constantly running around and saving people, still helping people. But there's also a tinge of hubris to the story, because he basically takes over the world. He wants to free the world and make everybody equal, just like communism. So he takes over the world slowly. Eventually, well, he first takes over the Soviet Union, then he takes over the rest of the world later on. Never shows it. And he has constant battles with Lex Luthor at the same time. And Lex Luthor is the same prick he always was. He's a good guy now. He's just a complete dick, though, still. He's married to Lois Lane because, well, Superman never grew up in Smallville, never moved to Metropolis.
And isn't it his right-hand Jimmy Olsen?
Yeah. Jimmy Olsen's actually a government agent. And one of my favorite moments, if you have to basically read the whole story to get it, though, is after all these battles that Lex Luthor has with Superman, all these fucking supervillains he creates, all these deadly traps, he takes Superman down with one sentence. That's it. Just a sentence in a letter that Lois Lane gives him. And it says, "Why don't you put the whole world in a bottle, Superman?" And then he just fucking crumbles. He gives up. He sees that he's basically trying to control everything, and he can't do it. And he kind of fakes his death, and then it shows that over the years, thousands of years pass as the human race evolves. And basically, the human race becomes Krypton. And they send their child, Kal-El, back into the past.
Oh, that's right. They ended on a predestination paradox, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, it's been years since I've read Red Sun. I don't know if I still have in my collection or not. I do love a couple of things of it. The whole Big Brother aspect of it, and the Superman robots, as they're called, I believe they're called, because it's basically all the political dissidents and criminals are given corrective brain surgery.
Yeah, because Superman teams up with Brainiac.
Yeah, and that's where the whole why don't you put the whole world in a bottle comes from, right? Because he tried shrinking, was it Moscow? Or I know it's one of the major Russian cities.
Yeah, Brainiac captured one of them and he could not basically reverse it.
Yeah, and just for me, on a pure kind of fanboyish level, I love Batmanikov. I know he's not actually called that in the comic, but it's a Russian version of Batman.
Yeah,
you can't help because he comes in, and he's got like the Russian, you know, cap on with the bat ears poking out the top, and you know, and then what did they turn the Green Lantern into the Green Lantern Marine Corps or something like that, as I recall.
Yeah.
And Wonder Woman's in there, but I forget exactly what they did with her. Because, I mean, at one point she was all for Superman, and then she's like, screw that guy.
Because Superman, well, it's young in his career, just before he started to take over the world. like, well, take over, try to free the world with communism, I guess. But Batman captured Wonder Woman and set Superman up with all these red sun lamps that he couldn't get out of. And he was basically pretty much fucked. He's gonna die. And Wonder Woman had to snap her lasso in order to get free. And if you know classic Wonder Woman, her powers, when she's captured in her lasso, she can't get free. She basically, her powers are connected to the lasso somehow. So once she snapped the lasso, she basically stopped being Wonder Woman. And after that, Superman discarded her. So that's why she had a chip on her shoulder.
And who did the art on Red Sun?
I can't remember.
I'm just going to look that up quick here. Talk amongst yourselves.
Absolutely. Well, while we're talking, let's talk about the next pick on the Red's list here.
Dave Johnson was the artist on that.
We got the All-Star Superman here. Another pick. It was Grant Morrison. You know, the concept is very simple. It's basically, what if Superman has 1 year to live?
And then it was also a celebration of everything Morrison loved of, like, the Silver Age sort of Batman, right? Or Superman, sorry.
Yeah. This comic, these two trades are basically, if somebody has never read Superman and doesn't understand Superman, basically says he's boring and his powers are too strong and there's nothing, how could you write a character like that? This is the comic that I would give them to prove that Superman's not about his powers. You can make him three times more powerful, just like Grant Morrison did. And he would still be a hero, and he would still be timeless, and he would still,
Superman.
Yeah. He's basically, it's a heartwarming story. The whole book is completely heartwarming. It goes straight back to Silver Age comics, where it's not about Superman and who he can beat up. It's about the adventures he has. And that's the story. That's what Superman is to me.
Now, I remember reading this when it came out in single issues in the store. And honestly, I was picking it up just because I was a huge fan of the team of Morrison and Quitely. Frank Quitely, who I came over from, like, their work on, like, The Authority and that on this story. But yeah, that's the whole Silver Age-ness of the story itself. And it goes back to, like, that one issue where he takes Lois for her birthday to the fortress
and gives her superpowers.
Well, not even that. It's like the stuff before. It's like they go up and it's like, what, you don't unlock the door with that giant key out there? And, you know, it's like the giant key that in classic Silver Age Superman unlocked the front door to the fortress.
He just has a mattress now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's still out there, like, a couple miles away, and it was used as, like, an airplane marker, but Superman replaced it with this key, and then he's got just this key under his floor, under his front mat, but it's made out of, like, white dwarf star material, so only Superman can lift it. You know, and it's got, like, the impression made, and you go in and you got, like, the Superman, oh, good afternoon, Superman, the experiment in Lab 3 is ready for your, you know, viewing, and it's just got all that goofy, you know, trophies, and I think they even had a reference to, like, the zoo, because he's got a baby sun eater in this pit.
Yes, and I love the sun eater.
Well, yeah, and just how he feeds it, he's literally got
an anvil.
An anvil, a hammer, and was essentially a mini galaxy that he hammers out mini stars, and he feeds it like he's like going back to his roots on the farm, feeding it like he would a bunch of chickens, just scattering it out, and, you know, the tentacles from the Sun Eater come up and he eats it. And then, yeah, he gives Lois superpowers. She becomes Superwoman for a day, and they have that bit where was it Samson and Hercules? These
come from Lois, yeah.
Yeah, and then they fight the Hyper Sphinx and just everything. Like, there's even that issue where, like, two other Kryptonians show up and they, like, Superman's out of action for a while and he comes back and they've kind of reinvented the world. And he doesn't just, like, beat them up. He doesn't beat them up. Like, he has a fight with them, but he convinces them that this isn't their world anymore. And he never, even with these, because the origin for those that don't know. Like, he gets solar radiation poisoning. He's dying, but his powers are like infinite or exponentially increasing, and he's essentially akin to a god at this point. But he never stops being Superman. He never stops being the Blue Boy Scout.
And what I love about it is it directly ties into the DC 1 million continuity, because in the DC 1 million continuity, you have Superman living in the sun, creating machines.
And, well, you have to fix the sun, basically, yeah.
And the thing is, I love DC 1 million. And anything that, like, pays respect to DC 1 million is something I just love.
I don't know if... Does it expressly tie into that, or is it just it's got that kind of allegory to it? I don't get me wrong. I mean, that's there, but I mean, because you have Solaris and Superman in the sun. And
considering that DC 1 million was Morrison's baby in the 90s, yes,
it directly ties into it for sure. Because you actually see the godlike Superman appear in the comic. It's not on the movie version of it. It's in the comic.
Exactly.
There's a kind of a bait and switch story in this comic. You're introduced to Superman. He's on the farm and he's talking to Pa Kent, and he's basically throwing a ball for Crypto the dog. And you follow him through this adventure where he's got to fight this giant time monster that's just pure fucking chaos. And while he's fighting it, suddenly he hears Pa Kent's heart stop. And this, to me, is one of the most touching stories in the book. Because he starts rushing towards the farm. He's like, I can save everyone. I'm Superman. I got to save my Pa. And he gets there too late. And it has the funeral scene where he's talking about all the morals that Pa Kent taught him. And that's basically... Pa Kent taught him to be Superman.
Exactly.
Yeah. You go back, Red.
When it's all done, after the funeral, there's a Superman from the future are basically showed up during this time to fight this monster, and they all attend the funeral. One of them is covered in bandages. And after they all start walking away, the one covered in bandages takes off his bandages. And that's the Superman that we've been following. That's a Superman that has 12 days to live. And he went back in the past to help himself fight this monster. And he smiles and he says, I'm glad I got to spend some time with my father before he died. Because in the background, you see the Superman with bandages helping Pa Kent farm, helping him till the fields, stuff like that. Just spending time with him.
Absolutely.
And then when they all go through this portal to walk away, the golden Superman of the future shows up, and he's like, here's a flower for Pa Kent, and it's from Krypton, and it'll never die. And they put it on his grave. But that golden Superman is the Superman from...
Superman DC. 1 million.
Okay.
Yeah.
He's not Superman 1 million, but it is the Superman from Superman 1 million.
Yeah.
Because for people to understand what I'm saying is in Superman 1 million... There is another Superman, which is the descendant of Superman, and it depends on how you read it, because it is the descendant of Superman after intermarrying with other species and stuff like that, including. Fifth dimensional imp somewhere in the line there, and his powers are highly evolved, but at the same time he draws most of his powers from the golden Superman. You have to read DC 1 million to understand it.
Now, while we're talking about All-Star Superman, what is your guys' opinions of the animated feature?
I think it's pretty good.
I like it.
It's missing some of the most touching parts, but it is fairly well put together for the parts they did put in.
First of all, Ed Asner as Perry White, well, that's perfect casting if there ever was. I think the best thing they did for the movie was getting Anthony LaPaglia to voice Lex Luthor. Because unlike, Brokeback Superman with James Marsters and Superman Doomsday. You know, this comes off as like a true, what do you call it, a true representation of the character. Because one of my favorite, and the reason I say this is because one of my favorite issues in the comic and one of my favorite scenes in the film was where, you know, Luther is basically going on trial. He's going to get elected. He's getting the death penalty for killing, quote unquote, Superman. And they have this whole thing where Clark goes to interview him in his like last days before he's put to the chair. And, you know, he's walking him through the prison. And it goes back to the whole Clark Kent Superman, like him just being, he never stops being a hero, how he uses his powers during this prison riot.
With the parasite chasing them.
And actually, who's voiced by Michael Gull. Like,
and one of the things I love
about Batman movies.
And what I also liked about that scene is Luthor says he actually always liked Clark.
Yeah, because it goes on that whole thing about, you know, you're here by your wits and your abilities alone as a human. And because he's almost like, because Luthor's, at least with hearing it said by Anthony LaPaglia in that scene, like the hate that Luthor has for Superman having powers and all that, you know, really comes out.
And the thing is, he actually points it out. He says, you know, you're a smart guy. You're a good writer. You have a great job. You're handsome, but always next to Superman, you're always going to come off as second best, Clark, is what Luthor says to him.
Yeah.
And I actually like the idea that Lex Luthor has some sort of strange and not Smallville-ish, fondness for the Clark Kent character.
Yeah, he's kind of got that respect.
Yes. And, you know, we could talk about this book all day long, but we still got a couple more of Red's titles to talk about. So, yeah.
So on to
G.I. Joe. AKA... no, not really. Danger Girl.
Yeah. So, Red, what originally got you interested in this?
Well, I was always a fan of J. Scott Campbell's artwork. So when this first came out, I basically started buying it as soon as it came out. And to me, a lot of the comedy and the action is what I liked about it, how it didn't take itself too seriously is what I loved about it, too.
Yeah.
It's like, what the hell is it?
Kind
Johnny
of had a...
Barracuda.
Oh, yes.
He basically cracked me. Like, I don't laugh easy. I find things funny and I chuckle, but actually laughing out loud, I don't do that really easy. And this comic, fucking on the middle of the bus, a quiet bus, riding home, I fucking laughed my ass off at Johnny Barracuda.
And everyone was giving you a dirty look?
Pretty much.
Yeah, I do like the first time you see Johnny Barracuda. He comes in, he's like, so, and it's such a cliche thing, but so many snow buddies, so little time, and he does like the smile with the ping, like that gleam off his eye. I just love that. It that made me laugh out loud too, maybe not as much as you, but okay, like we talked about this off air, but I mean, clearly a lot of the characters and some of the setup in the story was patterned after G.I. Joe. To an extent. I mean, you have that scene where I can't even remember. It's basically the Baroness for the Hammer Empire is like this evil Nazi or neo-Nazi organization. They basically go and jack the creator of Magic the Gathering, or was it Mystic the Enchantment or whatever they called it in the book. And you see her there and you're like, she's the Baroness. And then there's the Major Maxim, who's basically like, I guess he would be a Supenter analog or something like that.
Cobra, la 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 la.
Yeah, he could have been Nemesis Enforcer. I agree with Red when he says a lot of this book, like, it is a, like a great action, like 80s, 90s action adventure sort of tone to it, but there's a lot of, you know, dare I say, the whole sex espionage thing. Because they're supposed to be spies, but one of them is this bullwhip cracking Australia in an Emma Peel suit, and Sydney Savage, who is my personal favorite Danger Girl. Okay, I'm not going to lie. It's Abby Chase, but she's my second favorite. Anyway, her and Johnny basically fall in love in this first series. but it's when they're trapped in a dungeon in Hammer Island, and she basically seduces the guard into undoing her suit, because I really have to go to the bathroom. And, you know, that whole thing, and just the way J. Scott Campbell drew her face, she's got this, like, doe-eyed baby face on her, and she's like, you have to undo the belt. And, jeez, I mean, just, you see Johnny in the background, I can't believe this asshole's falling for this, so that the guy gets knocked out and they escape. And it's just really the way they build some of the characters. I mean, you have Sydney Savage, you got Natalia, who's like this icy, knife-wielding former Russian agent. There's Silicon Valerie, who's like the Doogie Howser of the team. There's their leader, Deuce, who's... Oh, it's James freaking Bond, okay? I mean, of course, the first time Deuce shows up, he looks like Sean Connery out of Medicine Man, and then he loses the ponytail.
Yeah.
I know, I think just overall, it's just a lot of the one-off characters are like the... Not the one-off characters, but the way a lot of the characters are these one-off homages to recognizable characters from other forms of entertainment.
Yeah.
So that's the thing I love the most in this. I mean, how about you, Ben?
The art. Just the art.
Yeah. Because if there's one thing J. Scott Campbell does well, it's cheesecake.
Pretty much.
That is true.
I mean, Abby did have to go undercover as a French waitress, of course. Her outfit was one size too small. And then, what was the name of the guy that was at the Peach? Is an arms dealer, and she serves him. You see her. Well, no. Well, in her head, she's where he comes into the hot tub later on. Yeah, but I mean, where she's trying. They're trying to stake out his meeting with this guy in Paris, and she's wearing like the server outfit, and it's a little bit too small. So when she bends over, her skirt has hiked all the way up, and you get that shot of her derriere, and the Peach is like, hey, you new here, girl? You know, I don't know you. And he just smacks her right in the ass. And you just see her, like, she's ready to just knock this guy out. And Sydney's like, we're on mission. But yeah, it's definitely the characters and the humor in here. And it's all benefited by J. Scott's art. Which is, I don't think he really did anything with Danger Girl after this, did he?
No.
Because the only... Until they did the G.I. Joe... Danger Girl crossover a couple of years ago.
It wasn't already a crossover?
No, it wasn't, Ben. The Danger Girl G.I. Joe crossover assumes they're in the same world the way the Transformers G.I. Joe crossover in the 80s assumed they were still in the Marvel Universe.
I see. So let's talk about some of your picks, JT.
Yeah, because I think we could safely save Red's final pick for last, because...
Yes.
That's
epic.
That's just going to be fun. That's epic indeed. I think go with what do you think is the weird? We'll go since we'll continue the theme. What do you think is the weirdest pick of my list?
Wild Siders.
All right. So I spoke about this a little bit in the last episode. So I'll just repeat myself a little bit. Wild Siders was a comic again created by J. Scott Campbell and Adney Hartnell, published by Wildstorm back in 2005. Unfortunately, never got past the second issue of a 5-issue mini. They haven't yet officially... It's never been officially canceled. Like, it's never said, yeah, Wildsiders is just... It's never going to be done. There's never been given a reason why it stopped. Which is one of the... It's never... I've gone in a lot of websites, forums. I've gone to the darkest parts of the internet and seen things no man should. There's never been a concrete reason given as to why it never made it past issue 2.
Well, my personal theory is, no offense to J. Scott Campbell, I am a big fan of his. If he ever listens to this, I'm not fucking trying to be a douchebag, but I'm pretty sure he has ADHD.
That could be a... No, again, just quick read. The storyline is a bunch of teenagers, specifically this skateboarder hacker type, creates a holographic technology where these kids have these suits that emit holograms, and they basically have amped up animal powers. Like, there's the one girl cat who is... her wild side is the panther, and it gives her, you know, increased agility and claws and superhuman hearing. There's the quarterback, Zach, he becomes a raptor with, you know, running speed and the talons. There's Bam, who's another jock. He becomes a gorilla. There's Jess, becomes an eagle. And Styler, who his wild side is the dragonfly. It's basically, they were just fooling around with all this stuff and having fun with it. And that's basically where the series ends, on that and the fact that there's this guy named Dr. Tiberius Spider, who's, again, as much as there were homages in Danger Girl, you know, there's a lot of homages in Wildsiders. And that's one of the things I love about J. Scott Campbell's work in these, is that, you know, he's unabashedly a fanboy. Like, I read in the Zero issue for this, is like, he specifically wanted to make these, like, this is basically an action adventure comic book movie mixed with a teen, you know, like Can't Hardly Wait or that sort of teen romantic comedy.
Because I hate about you.
Yeah, that too. I mean, because so basically the villain Tiberius Spider is patterned after Gene Simmons, because he was the former bass guitarist for a band called, I think it was Wicked Vixen. They mentioned that in the comic. And he's basically a weapons dealer, and he tries to steal this technology that Styler and Dr. Mira Martin created. Mira Martin looks like Halle Berry. Derek Styler looks like Alan Ruck, who we all know as Cameron from Ferris Bueller's Day Off, or Ben.
The Enterprise B captain.
Yeah, Star Trek Generations. Jess looks like Meg Ryan. Zach looks like Jason Marsden, Cyclops from the X movies. Bam is Jack Black. The only one I couldn't figure out was Jess, and I'm just going to say it's a Sean Dark. Maybe she was patterned after Shannon Elizabeth from the American Pie movies.
That's... I think you're right.
Yeah.
I was trying to figure out who the fuck she was.
And it's...
You're right.
I'd have to read the Zero issue. Unfortunately, I didn't have a chance to dig it out of my 20-some boxes of comics. But overall, besides the whole kind of Power Rangers, you know, meets the Breakfast Club sort of aspect of this series, another thing that drew me to it was the art, not just J. Scott Campbell's art, but also this is one of the first comics that used computer-enhanced art, specifically for the holograms that provide the Wildsiders their powers. So,
it's a little Power Rangers, a little Breakfast Club, a little Gem in the holograms.
Well, yeah. Yeah, damn. I never even thought of that before. Because they use the art, basically computer-generated art for the holographic shells that appear on the Wildsiders' bodies.
Gem in the holograms.
Yes, Ben. But just the way they laid this stuff over top, but you could still see the actual like pen and ink art underneath, was something that really drew me to this. Because I thought it was absolutely gorgeous. And like I said, sadly, we're probably never going to see the end of this series. Now, that being said, if you ever find at least the Zero issue in a back issue bin somewhere, I highly recommend picking it up, because one of the things they did to promote this in the Zero issue, which I picked it up because I figured this looks pretty cool, you know, nice color, good art, is they have a comic book movie trailer. There's about 5 or 6, 7 pages toward the back of the book that are specifically drawn and laid out as if this was a Hollywood movie-style trailer. And it completely sells the concept.
In a world where...
Basically. There, I said it. Are you happy? So, let's see. We go on from Wildsiders. I want to save the Taskmaster for last. If you go on from Wildsiders, there's Livewire's miniseries from Marvel Comics. I picked this up, you know, in 2005 when it first came out, because I had, through Gen 13 comics and the Titans, was it Paper, Scissors, Stone, one-shot that Adam Warren had done. Adam Warren's like an American-born kind of a manga artist, because he's very much in love with that style. And Livewires is basically the tale of a bunch of next-generation LMDs in the 616 Marvel Universe, whose mission is to seek out and destroy rogue black ops organizations.
Mm.
And it starts with them rescuing the newest member, who's this girl that you don't really know what her name is before, but her code name in the group is called Stem Cell, and she's basically a robot that didn't know she was a robot. And she becomes like our character to get into this world of like black ops organizations and killer androids. And she, like every member of the group, has a specific function. She's called Stem Cell because, like, her the guy she's replacing, Homebrew, she basically has a, where her stomach would be in human anatomy is a nanofactory that she basically creates and unfortunately pukes up pieces of technology that the other members of the team might need. You know, that's horrible. I think that's bad. One of the other characters is a guy named Cornfed. And he looks like a big old Oklahoma farm boy. And you think he's the muscle. He's really the mechanical expert of the team. And he basically fixes himself by eating like pieces of discarded nanotechnology from like all the rogue robots that they destroy. He's basically the coordinator. He sits in the van and calls things out during the mission. There's a gothic Lolita who basically looks like a Japanese girl in a gothic Lolita, you know, maid dress. And she's described as Ben Grimm in black baby doll lace. She is the muscle of the group. Wow. She's like, she's extra armored. You know, she's super strong. There's a Hollow Point Ninja who's literally, he's the stealth expert. He does ambushes. There's David Jenkins, who's a guy who appears only in flashbacks. He's basically the creator of the live wires. And the one that was kind of my favorite, because it just kind of plays with the conventions of like women in spycraft, and that she's called Social Butterfly, and she basically is the information specialist, but she can morph her facial expressions, her body, you know, like that scene in T3 where the Terminatrix grows her chest like 5 sizes in one day. She can do that. She can modulate her voice. She can generate pheromones. She's basically the seductress of the group.
Mm.
And they go, and you see them, it's through basically an average 2 days in their lives, but there's this overarching story of there's these rogue LMDs that all have Nick Fury's face in the background that they have to take down. And by the end of the series, one of the best scenes in the series is this one where they go after these sentient Fury LMDs, and you see what the reason these guys exist, this specific set of LMDs exists, is because this one time Nick Fury went into a bar to have a beer, and there was a Hydra agent there, and he knows Nick Fury really likes this one microbrew. So Hydra breaks into the microbrewery and infects every batch of this beer with nanotechnology, and Nick Fury found this out, because one time he sends in an LMD to check a bar out and make sure it's cool, and he opens his favorite bottle of beer, and all of a sudden the blob leaps out of the bottle and kills the LMD. And then Nick Fury walks in, he's like, oh, jeez, now I got to find a new favorite beer. And I mean, overall, like, it's Adam Warren's got a very, like, manga-inspired art. I mean, did he work on Bubblegum Crisis, or is it just Dirty Pair?
Just Dirty Pair.
Yeah. Because you see, if you've ever seen Dirty Pair, you know, he's got a love for that style of art. And it was just a lot of fun, because this had this whole cyberpunk aesthetic with the androids and androids killing androids and some of the good old ultra violence. But he also had a lot of sense of humor. Like, there was this one where they drop gothic Lolita onto a plane, or it was a rogue helicarrier or something. I haven't read this in a while. And she walks out of the ocean onto this beach, and she's like, here's Stem Cell, I brought you a present. She's got a starfish in her hand, and she's like, look, it can dance. She's like, da-da-da-da-da, and just making it dance. And it's like, that's funny. You know, it's completely out of nowhere and everything, but it's funny. Because there's these little moments of humor that are come out in every issue. And I don't know, if you guys, either of you guys read this one?
I've peeked at it. But let's talk about your untold legend of the Batman.
Yeah, because we know what Red doesn't like Adam Warren. That suffice to say, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay, we'll just leave it at that.
He used to draw noses.
He used to. But yeah, the untold legend of Batman is this came out. It was came out in 1980. I didn't discover this until about 10 years later, when I was just around 10 years old, summer of 90, just when I was getting out of those, you remember you used to have those read-along books that you'd listen to on cassette as a kid?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I got the third issue. It is a three-issue mini, and each issue later on came out with its own audio drama on tape, and it had the signal, you know, turn the page. But the overall story is really what got me into it. It was written by Len Wein, one of my favorite all-time DC writers. Art by two of my all-time favorite artists. It's pencils by Jim Byrne and inks by Jim Aparo. And I said before the show that that's kind of, because just looking it up here, I didn't know Byrne was involved with the art at all. I thought it was just Len Wein and the inker was kind of off his game that day. But it's that meshing of these two artist styles. It's not that I didn't like it. It was a little off for me. But the basic story is somebody has taken the bat costume that Dr. Thomas Wayne wore to this costume ball years ago that also kind of subconsciously inspired Bruce to create Batman.
And it looks a lot like the classic suit.
Like, yeah, with the wings spread out and the tall ears. This Batman, he gets this package in the mail with the shredded costume and a note that says, "This is only the beginning, Batman. Before I'm done, I'll destroy you." And over the course of this series, it goes into the origin and backstories of almost the entire cast of characters that you've ever seen in Batman. It goes into, like, you know, Batgirl's origin, Batman's origin, Robin's, you know, how Batman and Commissioner Gordon first met and kind of teamed up. You get the classic views the classic depictions of many of the classic villains like the Joker and Penguin. And you also kind of get into the inner workings of stuff in Batman's world, like how he gets his Batmobiles made. Well, he saved the world's greatest stunt driver and / stuntman. So whenever he wrecks the Batmobile, he calls this guy up and, you know, he gets off set for a month and goes and builds him a new car. And you see kind of things that, like, the introduction of how Lucius Fox first got into Bruce's good graces. And honestly, and it even has an update on the classic Bruce Wayne revealing himself to Joe Chill that he did in, like, the Dick Sprang days.
Yes.
And it has, like, he, you know, because, I'm Bruce Wayne. And then Joe Chill goes out and they alter the origin. They find out that Chill wasn't just a random mugger, but he was sent by boss Lou Moxon to kill
the Waynes in retribution, because the night that Thomas Wayne wore the original bat suit, he beat up Moxon himself, actually.
Yeah. And then Batman goes to confront Moxon. Moxon, who's had amnesia for years, all of a sudden he remembers and he runs out into traffic and it's like hit by a bus and there you go. And this whole time that Batman's going through to figure out who it is and who keeps futzing with his life. Like, they have this one thing at one point, there's a bomb in the Batmobile and it blows up. And this is at a point where the Batcave was underneath the Wayne Foundation Tower in the middle of the city, which, yeah. I always, that's one element of, like, the 60s, 70s Batman. I love that, you know, Dick Grayson went to college and he made a new Batcave, you know, it was the first of many satellite Batcaves. The thing that a recurring element in these three issues is that Batman was caught in a warehouse explosion. And by the end of it, he goes back to the Batcave. And I guess part of the security system is he's got, like, the classic, the walls are closing in going on. And he's sitting there trying to hold it open. And he sees the ghost of Bruce Wayne he's like, "I'm going to kill you, Batman. And finally, Bruce Wayne will live again." And then Thomas Wayne in the costume shows up and tries to convince Batman, like, "Look, this is all in your head. You've got a brain injury. You've got temporary schizophrenia." And just as they're about to both die and Thomas is about to sacrifice himself, Batman saves them both. It's really Dick Grayson who's come back to, you know, help Batman. And he needed that shock to, you know, get his head back on sorts. And I think we talked about favorite Batman a while ago, and there was that one line that they ended the third book on. I'm just trying to find it here quick. Here we go. Was it, this thing would only, I wish the internet would work when I wanted it to. Just give me a moment. Mm-hmm. Okay, so, and this is the last thing, and this is forever etched into my mind as one of my favorite Batman comics because of this. Every night, without cease, without slumbering, the Batman prowls the streets of the city he loves, the Dark Avenger, the Eternal Champion. For the Batman is a legend, and legends can never die. And goddamn, I feel like fist pumping having just said that out loud. But I mean, that's what I mean. This comic is like a distillation of everything I have ever loved about Batman. And on top of it, two of my favorite artists of all time. So I mean, really, this is like, this is a grand slam, bottom of the ninth, two strikes and three on deck. You know, it's that good to me.
It is absolutely fantastic. It is a great choice.
Yeah. What did you think of that, Red?
It sounds good. I wouldn't mind checking it out myself.
Yeah, if you can find the, I know it's been collected in a trade, but I haven't seen the actual, like, a full-size trade for a while. It does pop up now and again in more of a digest-sized style in some stores. So, if you can find it, I would highly recommend it. Now, my last miniseries today is a favorite of mine for a lot of reasons. One, well, I should say it's the Taskmaster. It's been collected as Taskmaster, The Right Price in Trade. Sometimes it's when I seriously, after a few years of just picking up stuff here and there, this is when I started getting back into collecting seriously somewhat. It was 2002. It's my introduction to Udon Studios. Now, Udon's a studio, they've primarily been known the last few years for doing the Street Fighter comic books that have come out.
Yes, with Umar Dagan.
Umar Dagan's one of them, Rob Ross, Alvin Lee. Alvin Lee actually did the first, because they used about, I think it was like four different, I have to look up on the different issues here, but I know Alvin Lee did at least two issues. The fourth issue has a cover done by Joe Madureira, who's one of my all-time favorite artists. Like, you can't not love this guy, in my opinion. And it's just Taskmaster. I'm going to have to put it in the chat here. It's basically Taskmaster done in a kind of a John Woo style pose. Where the heck did... You know what? I'll have to... Oh, here it is. I'll have to show you guys. But it's basically Taskmaster, for those that don't know, is a character. He's basically a mercenary in the 616 Marvel Universe. He has a skill known as photographic reflexes, which basically means he can watch Spider-Man, Daredevil, and Iron Fist fight, and then he can fight just like him. Like, he's a physical mimic. And this was also the debut of what's called the Udon suit. It's instead of like the skull mask and more pirate-themed costume he's been known for, it's more... more like a SWAT sort of suit, like special forces sort of suit, you know, padding, pouches, gun holsters. And what the story is Taskmaster is hired by Sunset Bane, who is an Iron Man villainous, to steal some stuff from Stark Industries. Then he's also hired by her to take out, I think it's the Triad. And then when he goes to get paid, you know, you see a conversation between Sunset Bane's number one goon and her, and she's like, oh, if only he hadn't asked why. And basically sets all these dirty cops on him, and it becomes this sort of revenge thing of him trying to meet this chick, have a date with this chick that he met in Vegas, and she gets wrapped up into it, and just basically Taskmaster trying to get his revenge and on Sunset Bane. And it's a fairly... In some respects, it's a fairly cliched story, but in some respects, it's something that I hadn't read in comic book form. I mean, I'd seen this in movies for years. But it's something about the characterization of Taskmaster in this, in that he's just a dude doing a job, you know. He's got a nice place. He wants to make payments and get his yacht finished built. He has tastes. You know, they have one of the things, the second issue, you know. I learned how to cook watching cooking shows, watched a golf game to pick up some stuff to improve my game. And it's just something about the character itself. He's been around for years. I just love the idea that there's this mercenary character. You know, he can copy fighting styles, you know, basically one of the baddest dudes on the planet. And this is just an average day in his life. So it's, I mean, because there's a lot of minutiae in the individual issues to get into, and too much so here. But it's some that I've always loved for years, A, because of the art, and B, because of the story. Because, I mean, it's some that really, it had so many great tastes mixed together in one thing.
I see.
So, I know, have you ever read this one?
I've actually peeked at this one. Now, honestly, I'm not sure how I feel about this version of Taskmaster. It's, I think part of it is I'm used to the, quote,
pirate
look.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing is this, is people tried to make the Taskmaster deeper than what he is before, and I've never found it done in a satisfactory way. Not to say it can't be done in a satisfactory way, but I was never really wowed.
Yeah, and see, that's the thing, I think you hit it on the head right there. It's not, he's not a character necessarily that needs to be really deep, but they gave him just enough depth in this one. Like, he's still a criminal. He's still a bad guy by the end of it. It's not like this
turn. Just because you're a bad guy doesn't make you
bad. A bad guy. Yeah, it's the whole Wreck-It Ralph thing. Like, he's a bad guy, but, I mean, he's not a complete dick. He's not Lex Luthor by any stretch of the imagination. It's just he has a code, and, you know, it's been violated.
I like the Taskmaster that hung out with Deadpool.
Oh, like in the Agent X and all that?
Yeah.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's still, it's, I love his civilian identity is Tony Master, or T-Master on his card, you know, T-Master, task fulfilled. Like, the best thing, the one thing that I would love to see Marvel do going forward, like with their TV shows or some, a Taskmaster show would sell.
Well, the thing is this, the Taskmaster concept is kind of cool at first, and then when they try to, like, give a reason for his photographic memory, it starts going into stupid territory. Like, I remember someone did this whole thing where he had a wife and a family and a backstory. And
he's really a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent.
And what happens is, as soon as he remembers it all again, he has, like, a couple of hours where he is at peak performance, and then all of a sudden he forgets it all again.
Yeah. I mean, that was I think that was certainly an interesting idea and a cool spin, but it's cooler when he's this bad guy with, he gets into a fight with Iron Fist. Well, he can kick Iron Fist's ass potentially, because he's got Elektra, Silver Samurai, Daredevil, The Punisher, Spider-Man, all these heroes and other villains in his repertoire.
He has the fast forward button cheat.
Yeah, that was one of the cool things that they did in the last issue, where he watches, like, old, like, Shaw Brothers Chop Saki films, and he watches it on Fast Forward, and then he can, you know, imitate those moves in Fast Forward, but only for basically until his body wears out. But, yeah, this is, like, one of my favorite characters, just for it's a pretty simple in some respects, and you can do stuff. But then people go and try to make it better or deeper, like you said, with the other Taskmaster miniseries, If Looks Could Kill, and it just kind of cheapens what's so good about it.
I think the thing is this. It's like, let's talk about some lame villains, like The Spot.
A lot of potential, weak execution.
Because there was one time when The Spot was late to a Sinister Six meeting. No, it wasn't Sinister Six, it was another... one of the lamer villain groups. And he was late because he couldn't find a place to park his car. And when he said that, the villains, like, all gave this look like, dude, what's your power again?
Yeah, just one of those, like, oh, jeez.
And to me, Taskmaster, he's not quite at that level, but he's a guy with an interesting trick. And, you know, sometimes he works as, like, the snarky buddy of Deadpool. But other than that, I don't really see a use of the guy.
Well, I mean, he's one of those characters, like, I don't disagree. Like I said, I personally love the character. He's one of those guys that...
No, I never said he was lame. I don't think he's as lame as, like, Stilt Man or...
Stilt Woman. No, I shouldn't say lame. It's he's one of those guys that the writer, whoever's writing, they got to absolutely love him. Like, they got to have that passion for the character, which would make it, you know, because if you have somebody that's truly passionate about a character, well, some great stuff comes out. And that's what I loved about this miniseries is, you know, the writer. Oh, God, I just forgot who it was. Give me a second here. Ken Xu Chong. Yes. I don't recall anything else that this guy's ever written. But he obviously had a passion for the character because he didn't make him a complete joke in the series. You know, he made him really cool. He gave him, like I said, just a little bit of depth, but not so much so that, you know his mother abused him or something like that. Like, you know what you need to know,
and you know, we go forward. Peter Parker suffered from the bad touch when he was a kid.
Sure. Anyway, we're going to go back to Red now, and it's something that I think we can all agree is one of the best crossovers.
I know, but the thing is, it's such a great crossover. I think it deserves its own show. We're talking about JLA Avengers, and this is fantastic. And like I said, I want to dedicate a whole show to this. So other than just saying I love the art, and I love the writing, I don't want to spoil too much until we do this as its own show. What do you think, guys?
I agree with you completely on that.
Red?
Sure.
All right.
I do want to say, and I'll say it again when we do the episode, this was the reunion of my favorite Avengers creative team of all time, which was Kurt Busiek on writing and art by George Perez.
Anytime you have Perez doing the art, you have magic.
All right.
And on that note, we are wrapping up. This is your host, Ben.
And JT from Saskatoon.
Red Ink.
And we are saying goodnight.
So long.
Sayonara.